Acts 27. My grandfather ran away to sea when he was 12 years of age. And they caught him, took him home, and he said it was no point because he's going to run away again. So they, my great-grandparents made a deal with him. They said that if he stayed at home till he was 14, they would apprentice him properly. And so he agreed, kept his part of the bargain, and they kept their part of the bargain. And when he was 14, they took him up to Greenock, lied about his age. They said he was 16. I still have his apprenticeship certificate with the false age on. And my grandfather spent the next few years sailing around the world until he came home on leave and met my grandmother and stayed to get married. Sailing should be in my blood because of that, but it isn't. And I should be at home on the open sea, but I'm not. So I have every sympathy with the Apostle Paul in this reading. I'm also an inveterate fan of, or at least not a fan, but I'm intrigued by the wreck of the Royal Charter off the coast of Moelvre here, one of the great sea wrecks of the British Isles, in a terrible storm, the storm of the century in Victorian times, and when over 400 people lost their lives. And it's a terrible story of how a ship foundered just maybe 20 metres offshore in Moelvre, and only, I think, 40 people, all men, survived. That was because there were reasons for that. They happened to be all men. And having read that, I can then understand the predicament of the Apostle Paul. I have never preached on this chapter, and in all my life, I have never heard anyone else preach on it, and when I get into it, you'll probably understand why. I'll do my best with it. We'll read it slowly, and we'll go through it. We'll unpack it. I'll make a few observations and a short meditation, and we'll finish at that point. Last week, we were looking at why the Bible was written. We were looking at how Luke was writing what he was intending. And this, in a sense, is the second part of that study. It comes on the back of being told as a chaplain at the university by a member of staff that the Bible's just a load of fairy stories, a load of myths. Well, as we read this story, you will see there is nothing mythological about this story. This is an eyewitness account of a terrible journey. And Apostle Paul is a prisoner. He was arrested on false charges. There was a plot on his life. And to save his life, he had to appeal to Caesar, as was his right as a Roman citizen, but that involved a trip to Rome for his case to be heard. Luke is with him. And you'll see from the map that's on the screen that it's going to be a long journey, and it's going to be a terrible journey, and it's going to take them a best part of 6 months to do it. So, Acts 27, we'll start the first one. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius. I want you to note that name, please. I'm going to ask you about it later. Who belongs to the Imperial Regiment. If you keep that in mind, I'll ask you about that later on. We boarded a ship from Adramyttium, about to sail for ports along the coasts of the province of Asia. And we put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. Aristarchus came to faith during the studies that we've been following. He's a relatively new Christian. And the next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friends so they might provide for his needs. So we just keep that on the screen, please, Paul. Yeah. They've boarded a coaster. It's a small ship. It's never going to get them to Rome. It's never going to venture out far to sea. It's hugging the coast all the way to modern-day Turkey. Julius, you'll notice, another of Luke's generous and kind centurions. I'm sure they all weren't kind and generous. But whenever Luke mentions a Roman centurion, he always presents them in good light, and you might like to consider why. I'll try and unpack that in a moment. So let's move on to the next verses. From there, we put out to sea again and passed to the lee of Cyprus because the winds were against us. When we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There, the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board. Now, please, can you keep that on the screen? Yeah. They're struggling against the wind. The wind is against them, which means they're having to tack back and forth along the coast. Small ship, slow journey. They're losing time. This is turning out to be much slower than they expected. And they land in Myra. Now, if you're looking at that map, Alexandria is down there in Egypt. You'll note that Myra is directly north of Egypt. And there's a reason why they pick up this ship in Myra. It has come from Alexandria, and it is carrying wheat to Rome. This is very important because the Roman emperors kept the population of Rome quiet by giving them wheat. And the wheat came from Alexandria. It was known as the breadbasket of Rome. And the stability of the city of Rome depended on this wheat arriving so that the population had plenty of cheap food to eat. And some of the ships would call in at Myra on the way because it's directly north. So they, instead of going straight to Rome, they take the short passage, shorter passage, straight across the Mediterranean. At Myra, they'd stop, replenish the vessel with food and water, and then sail on to Alexandria. It's a much bigger ship than the one they've been on. This would be about the size of the ocean-going ships of the early 18th century that used to call in Amluch and load up with copper and take the copper all around the world. If you've ever been to Amluch or been to a Paris mountain, there's an interesting trip down history for you to do one day. And these were bigger ships, and it was not only had wheat on board, it was also carrying 276 passengers. One suspects it was rather overloaded, but we don't know that for sure. And it is about to set off on the trip to Rome. So let's move on. We made slow headway for many days, because the wind's still against them, and had difficulty arriving off Cnidus. And when the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete, opposite Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens near the town of Lassia. Now, they're going nowhere fast. They sail 100 miles to the tip of Turkey, but the wind's against them, so they decide they'll kind of go south and see if they can make a bit of headway. Perhaps they'll catch a more favourable wind. And so they sail for Crete to the port of Fair Havens. Now, things are getting a bit sticky because it's getting later on in the year. Nobody sailed those oceans between the months of November and the spring. The last day anybody was out on those seas was our November the 11th. And from September, mid-September to mid-November, it was the dangerous season. It was prone to huge storms, and you didn't want to get caught out at sea in that time. And certainly, if you were sailing to Rome and November was coming, you considered laying up in port until the spring came and it was safe to sail. All right? And they've reached a place called Fair Havens. Now, that might suggest to you this would be a good place to spend the winter. The place is called Fair Havens. It's giving something away in its name. Let's see what happens. Much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous, because by now it was after the fast. Now, in AD 59, when we think this happened, the Day of Atonement, the sort of Day of the Fast, October the 5th. So, well, we're into October now, and the likelihood of reaching Rome is slim. And it's not a great map, actually, is it? But hey, you've got a picture of Fair Havens. And everything says, really, we would want to spend the winter there. We think at this point there's been a change of wind. And the wind is now coming from the south. And one thing you need to know is that the Emperor Claudius used to give bonuses to ships that got in to Rome in late October or early November. It was a big bonus if you delivered wheat to Rome at that time. And the captain is thinking, the wind's changed to southerly. That's a good wind. That would get us to Rome in a couple of weeks or so. Maybe if we just sail up the coast of Phoenix, which is a harbour that suited him better, we can make a decision there whether to spend the winter in Phoenix or take a risk. And if the wind is favourable, perhaps make a run for Rome and pick up that bonus and spend the winter in Rome. So much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the fast. So Paul warned them, "Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives." But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, and why should he, followed the advice of the pilot and of the owner of the ship. Since the harbour was unsuitable to winter in, they thought, the majority decided that we should sail on, the problems of democracy, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. This was a harbour in Crete facing both southwest and northwest. It's now silted up, by the way, so it doesn't do that anymore. It was a result of an earthquake. And so the idea was that they're sailing along the shore, because they don't actually have much choice because of the direction of the wind at that point. It means nothing at all to me, but I'm told that ships in those days could only lie close to the wind up to 7 points. And I know some of you are sailors, and that undoubtedly means something to you. It means nothing to me. It just means, I suppose, they couldn't sail directly into the wind or whatever. But there you go. Whatever happens. So they're out again. They set off with the wind nicely in the right direction. But then, verse 13, we move on. When a gentle south wind began to blow, they thought they'd obtained what they wanted, so they weighed anchor, sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the Northeaster swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm, and could not head into the wind. So we gave way to it and were driven along. So wind was notorious in the ancient world. They called it the euroquilo, an odd word. It's a word that combines Greek and Latin, unusually for a word, but it's half Greek, half Latin. It was the northeaster. And it was known to be very powerful and very strong, and it was greatly feared. And it came out of the blue. Suddenly that favourable wind is lost, and the northeasterly hits them. And there's no way they can sail north at this point. Any hope of sailing up to Phoenix is lost. The wind will not allow them to do it. The Royal Charter was caught on its way to Liverpool by a similar kind of wind, a hurricane force northeasterly. Couldn't sail to Liverpool. In fact, they put out the sea anchor. They had a little engine on board. It was a clip with the engine on board. Even the engine couldn't keep that ship going north or in any direction, and it was driven backwards onto the coast of Anglesey at Moylesford. And the same thing is happening to Paul's ship, except it's not being driven onto land, it's being driven away from land, and it's getting worse. They have a choice at this point. The sailors have a choice. What little steerage they can manage on the ship, they've got a choice. They can either be blown westwards or be blown southwards back to Africa. So we go on to verses 16. As we passed the lee of a small island called Cowder, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure. And when the men had hoisted it aboard, they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together, fearing that they would run aground on the sandbars of Syrtis. They lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along. We took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. No bonus for them. On the third day they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. And when neither sun nor stars appeared for many days and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. They were scared of being driven south because they were heading straight for the sandbars of Syrtis, which were off the coast of modern-day Libya and off Tripoli and Tunisia. These were notorious sandbars that once the ships got in, they couldn't find their way out. It was the last place that sailors wanted to end up. Because even on a good day, it was dangerous. You could sink and get stuck there. You avoided at all costs. And they were being driven by the wind directly south towards that. So they put out the sea anchor, steer as best they can, and just allow to be driven westwards. But because they can't see the stars of the sun, they don't actually know where they are. They have no idea. They've lost all sense of where they are on the map. And they just hang on. They do what they used to do. They used to put ropes. They would put ropes under the ship and put them tight to stop the timbers shifting. And then the ship was taking on board water. They didn't want to throw the people overboard, so they threw the wheat overboard. And then the ship's tackle. They lighten the ship as best they can to try and keep it floating as best they can, but they really are not sure that they're going to manage it. They can't, obviously, if they side on to the wind, they'll capsize. And they get driven 476 miles like that. That's a long way to be out of control. So we move on to verses 21 to 26. After the men had gone for a long time without food, they'd all been as sick as dogs. And let's face it, all seasick. Luke is being quite polite at this point. But they've all been seasick, and none of them have been able to face food for days. After the men had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, "Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourselves this damage and loss." I'm sure they loved him for pointing that out to them. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night, an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood beside me. And at this point, the first words of hope they've heard in days. An angel. Maybe, as long as it's not the angel of death, we might just escape this. And the angel said to me, "Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. And God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men. For I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island." And on to verse 27. On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea, when about midnight, the sailors sensed they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. Short time later, they took soundings again and found it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that we would dash against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for the daylight. In an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurions and the soldiers, "Unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved." So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it fall away. The sailors really loved Paul at this point. On to verse 33. Just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. "For the last 14 days," he said, "you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head." After he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them. And then he broke it and began to eat. They were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. And when they eat as much as they want, they lightened the ship by throwing the rest of the grain into the sea. On to verses 30, where am I? I've lost my place now. Yep, when daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. Cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach, but the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. We've had this year, haven't we? That great tidal surge we had back in January. We had those high seas which wrecked the seafront in Aberystwyth. And we're aware what that is. Now, if you're stuck on a ship with its bow stuck on a sandbank and those waves are smashing onto the back of the ship, if the stalwart seafront of Aberystwyth did not survive, imagine an old wooden ship. And verses 42 to 44. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to get there on planks or on pieces of the ship. In this way, everyone reached land in safety. And they're still on Malta, a bay known as St. Paul's Bay, where the Maltese believe that the Apostle Paul and his crew and his ship ran aground. It's a strange chapter in the Bible, isn't it? Dramatic. As you go through it slowly, you begin to feel the drama. So why was it in the Bible? Why would Luke put a chapter like that in the Bible? Remember that the Bible was written on highly expensive vellum. It would have cost an awful lot of money to buy the material to write this book. And it's a long book. It would have taken a long time to write, and Luke wrote it surely in the hope of it being copied and passed around the churches. So why does he take up an entire chapter with a story of a shipwreck? Well, if you're going to attack the Christian faith, you attack it on the basis of the Bible. That's what people do. They dismiss it as a load of fairy stories, a load of myths. If you're going to attack something, you say it didn't happen. And Luke is very aware of this. And he very carefully, we saw this last week, he has very carefully chosen the kind of book that we call a biography, the ancient biography. I had to study one at school, Julius Caesar's De Bello Gallico. It's full of eyewitness accounts. And they would traditionally name names. And the idea was that any biography of great men, great people, or great events had to have names in it so that you could check it up. Now, you immediately, on reading this chapter, you see there is nothing fictional about this chapter. It rings true with eyewitness reports. There is zero evidence, no evidence at all, that this book was written in the second century. It is a first century book. And we know that these books, these gospel stories, were written in the first century, because by the end of the first century, they've already been copied and are starting being quoted and alluded to by Christian authors like Clement of Rome in 96 AD, like Ignatius of Antioch in 110 AD. These guys know the scriptures. The scriptures have been copied. They've read them, and they've used them in their teaching, and they're alluding to them. These books had been spread by the end of the first century. These are very first century books. And Luke is writing, and he's following the pattern of, you've got to say it like it is. And you've got to know what's going on. In our modern society, we do the same kind of thing. How about, for example, if you're going to buy a house, you see the estate agent's spec, don't you? I just found a few estate agent specs. Here we go. We just have a few houses that might be of interest to you. Have these on the screen. It's computer waking up there. Here we go. Here's the first one. Might say maybe the garden's a bit overgrown on this one. You won't fear about the house. How about this house? Well, at least they dragged the corpse out before they took the photograph. And this one wouldn't be photoshopped in any form at all, would it, really? And how about this one? You'd never get out of bed the wrong side. And finally, this one. What a shame the estate agent didn't open that trap door before he took the photograph. That would have been quite interesting photo, all the stuff falling on his head. Okay, so you're buying, you know what you're buying when you see those photographs. And in the ancient biographies, you had to include eyewitness reports. Now, here we come to my question. What was the name of the centurion? Oh, wonderful, Julius. And what was the name of Julius' regiment? The Imperial Regiment, Imperial Guard. Now, how about that? How good is that? Why does Luke tell us that? Because Luke is saying, you know, if you want to find out more, go and find Julius. Because he's the man. Luke deliberately names Julius and tells us his regiment, which is why Luke is always kind when he writes about centurions, because he expects people to go and ask them, was it really like that? Luke deliberately writes in the name of the eyewitnesses so that you can find out about the amazing miracle in which 276 people on board a ship that to all intents and purposes was lost were saved. Ask Julius, he says. So that is the longest Bible reading I've probably ever done. The longest introduction to a sermon I've ever done, and the sermon you like to know is going to be reduced to less than 10 minutes. But I want you to get the idea. The next time somebody tells you that the Bible is a load of myths or fairy stories, I was going to say spit in his eye, but that might not be a Christian way to tackle it. You know, just point out, actually, no, it isn't. There's a lot of poetry in the Bible. There's a lot of very old stories. But there's a lot of history in the Bible as well. And it was written as history. It was written by the standards of the histories of its day. And it was written so that people could check the truth in their own time. And that's why it's like it is. Now, Paul is on his way to Rome. In Rome, he's going to write one of his great letters, the letter to the Philippians. And he's going to have some memorable phrases in it, one of which is, for me to live is Christ, to die is gain. And if you've been that close to death, as often as Paul was, if you've been that close to death as you were on this voyage, 14 days expecting to drown, you can look death in the eye, and Paul does. And he says, for me to live is Christ. To die, well, that would be gain. I should know I nearly did. And many years ago, when I was a young man, a young Christian, victorious Christian living was in vogue. And you had to pretend to be happy in all circumstances, because you went under the circumstances, you're over the circumstances, which is great. But you can overdo it, I think. Luke tells us the horror of this journey. But I want you to know just three things what happens on this horrendous journey, which is this. God reminds us of his presence. When we're going through that storm, if we're going through the really bad, dark times in life, God reminds us of his presence. Let's just take a look back at verse 23, where God reminds Paul of his presence. Last night, an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood behind me. That can happen in so many ways. Not usually an angel, usually a visit from somebody in the church, actually. Come to stand by you in your dark times, to remind you that God is with you. God will always remind you of his presence in some way. It might be directly, it might be indirectly. Hebrews 13, verse 5 is one of my favorite verses. Keep your lives free from love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. God said, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you. And this came at a time when Paul didn't know where he was, other than they were in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea, didn't know how long this was going to last for, and at this point wasn't sure he was going to live or die. Paul was not in control of his destiny at this point. There was nothing Paul could do except follow it. Nothing he could do but go along with it. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 2, the feeling. That's why for Christ's sake I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I'm weak, then I'm strong. There are times you are locked into something you can't get out of. God stands by you. God reminds us of his presence in some way. Look out for it if you're going through a bad time. God reminds you of his presence. And secondly, God reminds us of his purpose. If you go on to verse 24 of Acts 27, God says, do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. And God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. In fact, with hindsight, we know there's an awful lot of work still to be done. Paul has yet to write his letters to the Philippians, to the Ephesians, 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, Philemon, and Luke has got to write the book of Luke and Acts. There's an awful lot still to be done. There's an awful lot of preaching to do, a lot of ministry to be done. Look, you and I, we are not guaranteed a long life. We're not guaranteed perfect health and 2020 vision. But we are guaranteed that we belong. We belong. Despite our limitations, we belong. We belong to God's purpose. God has a purpose for our lives. You and I are immortal until our purpose on this planet is finished. And then we go on to something else. God will not let us die until we have finished our time on earth. Now, for some of us, it's going to be many, many years. For some of us, it's going to be shorter. But God has a purpose, whatever. He reminds us of his purpose. You might have a major reversal in your career prospects, but God's got a purpose. You might develop a disability. God still has a purpose. You might go through a terrible, devastating divorce. God still has a purpose. You may make a terrible mistake. God still has a purpose. God reminds us of his presence and his purpose. And then finally in verse 25, God reminds us of his promises. Keep up your courage, men, says Paul. For I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Paul believes God's promises. If God has promised, it will happen. Paul knew he was going to be a prisoner in Jerusalem before he went there, and it happened. Paul knew he was going to go to Rome, and he's on his way there. It's a remarkable chapter. It's a remarkable chapter in which the experts get it wrong. The majority get it wrong. God gets it right. And God stands by his people in a storm. Next week we're going to have Nigel Wright with us, and I'm looking forward to that. The week after we're going to go to Paul on the island of Malta, and we'll be having a time of ministry in our service as we look at the remarkable way God uses people like you and me. But for the moment, let's stop here. The band, please, will join me on the platform, and we will pray together. Father, you remind us of your presence. You remind us of your purpose. You remind us of your promises. Some of us have been through dark periods of our life, and Lord, to be honest, you know that some of us are still going through dark times in our life. Some of us are struggling. Some of us, perhaps, in the course of the next 12 months, are going to find immense trials and tribulations. And we fear the future, Lord, because we're human and we can't see it. Like the Apostle Paul on his voyage, sometimes we're in the dark, in the middle of nowhere, we don't know where we are, don't know what time it is, what day it is, what's happening. Sometimes we're struggling. But thank you that you stand by us. Thank you that you are with us through the storm, that you never leave us and you never forsake us. Thank you that your promises ring true and are true. Thank you that you care for your people. Lord, give us this faith to stand up in the storm and believe that God is with us and his purpose will be worked out in our lives. So we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.